So thank you all for coming. It is my very great pleasure to introduce Craig Santos Perez. He is a native Chamorro from the Pacific Island of Guam. He is the author of two books of poetry from unincorporated territory, Acha, published by Tinfish Press in 2008, Exhibit A, and from unincorporated territory, Faina, published by Omni Dawn Publishing in 2010. This last was a finalist for the 2010 Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Poetry and the winner of the Penn Center USA 2011 Literary Prize for Poetry. His poetry, essays, fiction, reviews, and translations have been published in numerous scholarly and literary journals and anthologies, and he has also been the recipient of the Poets and Writers California Writers Exchange Award 2010, the Emily Chamberlain Cook Poetry Prize 2009, and the Jean Burden Poetry Award in 2001. He, in addition to his own writing, he has done a tremendous amount of editorial work in various capacities. He is the co-founder of Achiote Press, which publishes chapbooks, and with Brandy Nailani McDougall, the founder of Ala Press, which is an independent press dedicated to Pacific literature. He's also guest-edited several special issues on Chamorro literature and co-edited the anthology Chamorro Childhood from 2009. He's also, I should say, a frequent blogger, and he's blogged on his own blog, but also for such blogs as... one could say such blogs now as Harriet and the blog of the Poetry Foundation and the Kenyon Review, among others. He holds an MFA in creative writing from the University of San Francisco, and is completing or has completed a PhD in...
Never completed.
is ABD in ethnic studies, comparative ethnic studies from UC Berkeley. Since 2011, he's been the assistant professor of English at University of Hawaii in Manoa, where he teaches Pacific literature and creative writing and curates Native Voices, a reading and lecture series. So now a little word on his poetry. In the preface to From Unincorporated Territory, Acha, Exhibit A, Santos Perez describes his poetry as, quote, an attempt to begin re-territorializing the Chamorro language in relation to my own body by way of the page, end quote. His work is thus deeply engaged in what Haitian scholar Michel Rolf Trugio has called tracking power, a revealing of, quote, the differential exercise of power that makes some narratives possible and silences others, end quote. So using maps, diagrams, illustrations, and text in English, Spanish, and Chamorro, among other languages, and there is a real visual quality to his poetry that you won't see in a reading. So Craig's texts render visible both personal and collective narratives of Guam's history and present, and the narratives of Spanish and North American colonialism. Yet if this poetry is insular in its preoccupation with the experience of Guam as an island, it is not insular as in cut off from other historical narratives or poetic traditions. On the contrary, it is a poetry that is profoundly rhizomatic in relation with other narratives of colonialism and deterritorialization in conversation with other experiences of islandness. Brazilian poet Oswald de Andrade would call it anthropophagic, cannibalizing writing in the best sense of the term. Craig Santos Perez digests texts from writers as diverse and varied as Teresa Hak-Yung Cha, Paul Celan, Gertrude Stein, Aimé Césaire, Muriel Rukeyser, Robert Sullivan, and Oswald himself. Their words become the raw materials that, together with the Chamorro language, he uses to shape a new and vibrantly embodied sense of place. So please welcome Craig Santos Perez.
Well, thank you for that lovely introduction. Thank you all of you for coming today. I know everyone's busy time of year, so I really appreciate sharing time with us today. Thanks for all the organizers for bringing me out here. I know it takes a lot of work as I run a reading series myself, so I really appreciate all the paperwork and emails and travel arrangements. I'm so excited to be here. This is our last week of instruction at the University of Hawaii, so I escaped. Thank you for saving me. I did bring gifts. I brought a kind of case of spam with me. Unfortunately, I ate it all on the plane. I know, it was a long flight from Hawaii and I was really hungry. So instead of gifting you with spam today, I'm actually going to read you a poem about spam, which is just as tasty. So I'm glad you mentioned anthropophagy, cannibalism. I've been thinking a lot about issues of gastrocolonialism, how kind of our bodies become colonized by invasive foods. In the Pacific, kind of food issues, at least right now, are kind of at the forefront in terms of food security, food sovereignty. Hawaii is kind of the seabed of the GMO industry right now, so it's a big fight that a lot of, you know, both activists and writers are engaged with. As well, we have some of the highest rates of obesity in Guam itself. About 60% of all deaths are caused by chronic diseases linked to poor diet. So in my next book, I'm trying to address a lot of these food issues through poetry, trying to raise awareness in my own community through the literary arts. And I just turned in the final draft of my new manuscript for my next book yesterday. So I'm going to test out some new material on you guys today. So I hope you enjoy. This first poem is called Spam's Carbon Footprint. It starts with an epigraph from Paul Thoreau from his book, The Happy Isles of Oceania, Paddling the Pacific. He writes, "It was a theory of mine that former cannibals of Oceania now feasted on spam because spam came the nearest to approximating the porky taste of human flesh. It was a fact that the people eaters of the Pacific had all evolved or perhaps degenerated into spam eaters." Spam's carbon footprint. Guam is considered the spam capital of the world. On average, each Chamorro consumes 16 tins of spam each year, which is more per capita than any other country. Headline: Guam struggles to find its roots from beneath growing piles of spam. Even the 7 McDonald's restaurants on Guam feature spam on the menu. Welcome to Guam, where we will present you with a gourmet gift at your birthday, wedding, and funeral. A culinary legacy of American troops stationed in the Pacific during World War II, spam is also popular in Hawaii, the Philippines, Okinawa, and South Korea, all places with a history of U.S. military presence. In fact, spam may have been responsible for Hitler's defeat. The Allies would have starved without spam. Plus, it's processed, so I guess we can save it for the coming war between U.S. and China, right? Wow, I haven't seen this much spam since I lived on Guam and the car dealership there started offering a 50-pound bag of rice and a case of spam with every car purchase. In the devastating wake of Typhoon Omar, Hormel donated 40,000 cases of spam to the Salvation Army's disaster relief effort. The end result can be found in our newspaper's obituary pages. You can rub the entire block of spam, along with the accompanying delicious gelatinous goo, onto your wood furniture. The oils from the spam moisturize the wood and give it a nice luster. Plus, you'll have enough left over to use as your own personal lubricant, the perfect dinner date. It's true. Documentary poetics. Why didn't you tell me about the In Honor of Guam's Liberation spam? I'm trying to collect them all. Once, I was on a diet and spam faded from my consciousness. Then I met my future wife, who's Hawaiian, and spam became part of my life again, a true Pacific romance. Maybe the economic downturn will help people love spam instead of loathing it. Spam doesn't have to be unhealthy. I eat spam every day, and I'm not dead. Yet. Just switch to spam light. Despite rumors, spam is not made of such odds and ends as hooves, ears, brains, native people, or whole baby pigs. The name itself stands for Specially Processed Army Meat. Salted pork and more. Super pink artificial meal. Super pink artificial meal, snake, possum, and mongoose. Or, some proteins are missing. My uncle is the reigning Guam spam king. He won the last spam cook-off with his spicy spam meatballs. I will never forget the 2-pound spam bust of George Washington he made for Liberation Day. Toasted crispy on the outside with raw egg yolk in the hollow center. The kids loved it. Only a fool would start a company in Guam that provides spam protection. For Christmas, I bought a snow globe featuring a can of spam sitting on an island, Turn it over and a typhoon swirls madly, unable to unseat spam from its place of honor. I have a souvenir can I bought after seeing Monty Python's Spamalot on Broadway in New York City. Cost me $10 and is the most expensive spam I've ever bought. I will never eat it. Thank you. So I also have a poem about Vienna sausage. I'll read that poem a little bit later. Okay, so now I'm going to read from my first book of poems called From Unincorporated Territory, Hotcha. I do have a few copies that I brought with me if anyone would like one. I'm offering deep discounts today, recession discounts, $5 a book if you're interested. The poem I'm going to read is called Achoti. The Achoti plan is indigenous to Central and South America and the Caribbean. And it was brought to Guam by the Spanish colonialists through the galleon trade route. And the Achoti has been linked back to the Mayans, who used it as a food spice and dye, as body paint for war and rituals, and as pigments for arts, crafts, and murals. The leaves, roots, and bark have been utilized for their medicinal qualities. You can find Achoti powder in the ethnic foods aisle of some grocery stores in the U.S. My grandmother leans over the achoti plant and picks its ripe shells, our hands among the red vine leaves. An attractive pink flower made it a popular hedge plant in colonial gardens. Ahi, she says when I touch the flowers. Don't touch your eyes. The frail, blind body of San Vittorius, 1672, is led around by a rope tied to his waist. He refused glasses because if the poor were too poor for glasses, etc., he carried through the villages a small satchel, a breviary, a New Testament, lumps of sugar for children who could recite their prayers and catechism lessons. He's always Ifionmu, a Sunday school warden. If you don't say your prayers, you wake with bruises. No, Ahi. Achoti can be used to treat skin problems, burns, venereal disease, and hypertension. We carry the shells to her porch and de-seed their red hearts, place them in aluminum trays shining beneath the territorial sun. Anato in English, a poor man's saffron, lipstick tree. Our hands stain red, our nails. He baptized children in holy water and other waters became no longer holy. Teach them the way to heaven. He built a church in Hagatnya where I was baptized. He named us Haleta, Hagata. And when I rubbed my stained hands on my face and threw stones at the sky, my grandmother called me Matapang. Achoti can be used to treat heartburn, fever, and sore throat. The shrine of Father San Vittorius shows him baptizing Chief Matapang's newborn daughter, despite the fact that Matapang did not give him permission. The baby is held by her mother, and Matapang is shown from behind wielding his machete. After they killed San Vittorius, the native population was killed also, and dropped from 200,000 to 5,000 in two generations as a result of Spanish military conquest near you, Ifeonmu. They dragged father's body into a canoe and sailed to Tumon Bay, tied stones to his feet, and threw him beyond the reef. They say he rose three times before he finally drowned. Tumon, 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 from Tumhum, Ti Atmin Humun, our roots, Haleta. Spanish soldiers erected a small chapel of coral masonry and a cross where San Vittorius was killed, not far from where Magellan landfallen, 1521. Every April, a red tide of uni algal blooms covers Tumon Bay. They say it is the miraculous appearance of the blood of San Vittorius, Apudza Pale, Iguma as Pale. At father's house, it's getting dark, Ti Atmin Humum. My grandmother washes my face in her outdoor sink that she used to clean chickens. She told me her father held her hand and took her to the cliff's edge overlooking Tumon Bay to see the blood that looked to her like hair. Our blood, Hagata. In Tumon, you could stay at the Westin, Hilton, Grand Plaza, Marriott, Hyatt, Holiday Inn. The hotels are located off Pale San Vittorius Road, which runs parallel to Marine Drive, which was renamed Marine Corps Drive. The shrine of Father San Vittorius lies between Guam Reef Hotel and Sells Restaurant. Achote can be used to treat liver and blood disease, eye and ear infections, digestive problems. Quote, motives for not delaying further the conquest and instruction of the island of the thieves. End quote. My grandmother used achote to make chalakilas and red rice, so young when the Japanese army invaded and renamed Haganya Akashi, the Red City, bright red stone. Later, reports claim that Matapang sold San Vitoris's ivory crucifix for 30 bags of rice. Matapang, used to mean proud and brave, used to mean alert eyes, he led the rebellion against the Spanish before he was captured and killed. Now, Matapang means silly or rude or misbehaved or uncivil. Achote can be used to stop bleeding, used as an anti-venom for snake bites, used to heal wounds. Thank you. So just a little bit of history. The Spanish arrived on Guam in 1521, which was the first contact between Europeans and Pacific Islanders. And in the ensuing centuries, it became a Spanish missionary outpost, as well as an important stop on the Manila or the Acapulco-Manila galleon trade route. Yeah, because it's kind of Guam kind of lies along the north equatorial kind of ocean current, so that's how they got there, and it was the first stop and the largest harbor in the Western Pacific before they could get to Manila. And so, you know, besides Catholicism that the Spanish brought, they also brought pigs, which I always found interesting considering the Americans brought a spam. And so the next poem I'm going to read is the Vienna sausage poem. It's almost dinner time for me, so. The poem's called Shoplifting Vienna Sausages. And it also starts with an epigraph from another anthropologist, Francis Hetzel. His book is called The First Taint of Civilization, A History of the Caroline and Marshall Islands in Pre-Colonial Days. He writes, when the Spaniards returned to the ships later in the day, he's talking about the first contact, they brought with them the stolen skiff and a good supply of rice, fruit, and fresh water. They also carried a few buckets filled with the intestines of the slain natives to be distributed among the sick as a cure for scurvy. So one thing I should also mention, the poem I quoted about how the Spanish missionaries requested money from Spain to colonize the Island of the Thieves, and that was the name that they first gave Guam, Island of the Thieves, because when they were trading with my ancestors boarded their ship, you know, gave them food, rice, fruits, and so on, and expected something in return, but they didn't get anything in return, so they took one of the boats. You know, Magellan's crew didn't like that, so then they went on shore and destroyed an entire village and killed 8 people, and apparently took their intestines back to the ship so they could feed it to the soldiers. So what does that have to do with Vienna sausages? I've only shoplifted once in my life. A can of Vienna sausage just to see if I could do it. As an altar boy, I sang tenor in the Vienna Sausage Catholic Boys Choir on Guam. Boy, those priests loved our Vienna sausages. Vienna is supposed to be a city rich with culture and history, yet these sausages have none of that. North American Vienna sausages are made from mechanically separated chicken, finely ground to a paste and mixed with salt and spices, then stuffed in a long casing, cooked, after which the casings are removed. You should never serve Vienna sausages on a first date because they are limp and soft. It's true that the sausages have an unpleasant metallic aftertaste, but that's part of the allure since my people have a long history of trading for metal. When I take my toe rings off after a long day of teaching, my toes swell and look like Vienna sausages. Don't lie, that happens to you too. Last night, I popped off the top of the Vienna sausage can, drank the yummy broth, and had myself a little feast. Afterwards, I went upstairs, got my PJs on, updated my Facebook status, and finally got a chance to lie down in bed to read some avant-garde poetry and watch some pornography before bedtime. I had the most pleasant dreams. My future wife, who's Hawaiian, prefers a Portuguese sausage over a Vienna sausage, if you know what I mean. But she says she'll eat anything as long as it's served with poi. On my wedding night, I hope I will be able to plump like a ballpark Frank and not shrivel like a Vienna sausage. Some find it suspicious that Vienna sausage is cheaper than cat food, yet marketed in disturbingly similar packaging. When military personnel on Guam go snorkeling, they like to put Vienna sausages into Ziploc baggies, take them into the water, and crumble them over the reef. Within seconds, hundreds of bright-colored tropical fish swarm like an air show. My great-grandfather had mouth cancer, so he would mash Vienna sausages and mix them with rice pudding. My grandfather would mash Vienna sausages and make them into a sandwich with mayonnaise. My dad eats Vienna sausage as a chaser with his Budweiser. Somewhere on the western coast of the United States, a shirtless Chamorro suffering from a severe case of diaspora is kicking back with his Budweiser and a can of Vienna sausage saying, "Ah, this tastes like home." Thank you. So I've been in negotiations with Hormel, and I'm trying to get them to include in the back of my next book as a sleeve a little spam single. You guys ever seen those spam singles? So, you know, trying to find creative ways to market to my demographic, to my ideal audience. Okay, now I'm going to read a poem from my second book, from unincorporated territory, Saina. And, you know, for those of you who read my work, kind of know I'm working with the excerpt a lot. So kind of each book is an excerpt of a larger project. And each poem is also excerpts from longer poems. So poems from my first book are also retold or excerpted in different ways in my next book. Poems from this book are kind of rearticulated in the next book as well. So I'm kind of interested in kind of the serial project, the long poem. And, you know, personally, as a migrant, you know, I always kind of feel like I'm living an excerpted life, you know, where my heart is in one place, but my body's in another place. I'm kind of very interested in this idea of the living excerpt and what that means for storytelling and poetics. And so this poem kind of speaks to that issue of migration and movement. It's called Aerial Roots. And one of the most important cultural symbols back home is the banyan tree. In Chamorro, it's called Trunkin Nunu. And these trees are very interesting where they have these roots that kind of grow downward from the branches. And they're kind of reaching towards the earth, and they weave as they grow downwards, as gravity pulls them. And once they reach, they kind of weave together, and once they reach the ground, they root, and then they expand, so they form trunks, like new trunks, auxiliary trunks. And if these trees are let to continue growing, you know, over the centuries, they could have multiple trunks, and you don't know which one is necessarily the original trunk. So I'm thinking a lot about this idea of aerial roots moving around, trying to you know, find my place of belonging in all these different places that I lived. Aerial roots. Tongue. Once fly, Oceania, free in. Galaidi, Sakman. Hungen, 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 Magahit. Until fires anchored in reef, insular words, without bow or stern, Latin sail of finely woven matting, outrigger, balancing. Does not rely on force, but on ability to draw water. Tussy dreams, tussy hands carved and cast. 30 years ago on the island of Rota, carver and craftsman Thomas Duenas Mendiola gave my father 2 hand-carved model canoes with hand-woven sails, a Galaidi and a Sakman. The canoes remain on display in our house in Guam, and I used to daydream journeys across the Pacific with my Lego men as sailors. Today I called my dad and asked him how he packed the canoes to ship them to California when we moved here 15 years ago. He said, "I broke down the sail from the mainframe, the hull. Then I folded the sail against the body and wrapped in some cloth. But I was too afraid to ship them because they might break. You remember how all our pictures we shipped, the glass frames broke. I was afraid of that." And Mr. Mendiola sold many canoes on his ranch to all the rich tourists. "The canoes are too valuable to me. Many people have offered me money for them, but I won't sell. They are even carved from a special wood. I forget the name, but it's the same one our ancestors used to make the actual Galaidi and Sakman. So I cut up some cardboard boxes we were using to ship things, and I made a special box for each canoe, with the outrigger sticking out of my handmade box so I could use it as a handle. Even on the airplane, I didn't check it in baggage, but I carried it on. I put one under the seat in front of me and one under the seat in front of you. You remember? Bowsprits cut, planks cut, fitted to form. Skin friction and, teach me, wave drag, voice, to read the current, to fly. Lung, if breath is our only commonwealth, if we are evidence of what words bury, Sackman, I say it navigates the air, sanding, sanding, sanding. Is remember the first time I paddled, freshman year at Chief Godow Academy, 1994. Chief Godow is the ancient chief of the southern village of Inalahan. They say the village name could sell from the word Allah, coconut leaf woven baskets, which the village was famous for. Prayers, flay, wood, treated to strengthen. Hungan, 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 magahit, signs of crossing. Mast, yard, boom, sail, rigging. They can't bury light even if they burn our word for light, even if we have no nation. To say Sina, I say Sina. Is remembered our class practiced our counting outside, sitting in a field aligned with our group. Our teacher, Mr. Flores, recited Hacha, Hugwa, Tulu, Futfut, Lima. We repeated after him, Hacha, Hugwa, Tulu, Futfut, Lima. He held his stick chart to the sky. Hungan, 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 Magahit. When water grips the end of my throat, Husangan, Sina, so far away, say we can cross any body of water if we believe in our own breath. I don't remember who told me that the reef around Guam is made of our bones, burial in every wave. Is remembered Mr. Flores explained that this was how our ancestors counted, Hacha, Hugwa, Tulu, Futfut, Lima. I had never heard these numbers before. When my dad counts, he switches tacks between English and Spanish. Grandma counts in Spanish. When she read my first book, she asked, what does Hacha mean? I said, Hacha means one. She looked surprised, asked in what language. In Chamorro, I said. She replied, I speak Chamorro all my life and I never heard that word. One is uno in Chamorro. No, Grandma, that's Spanish. She looks confused. Hacha, Hacha, she repeats, feeling the sound in her mouth. Maybe you mean Hatsa, she said. Hatsa means to hit. Uno is one. I never heard of Hacha. Yet, the sail of the canoe pulses. Once and now to let guide, to prove Oceania is still our flag, to prove moving islands, Sina, Husangan, say to voice all the way to the sun, Hungan, 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 Magahit. Through thousands of miles of blood on a canoe, unraveled, unshelled, unaccustomed, there's no other act as simple as clothing, as closing my eyes. Hungan, 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 Magahit. Bone, my dreams whole, is remembered when we perfected our counting and rhythm. Mr. Flores gave us paddles to practice. Our group held our paddles on alternating sides. He showed us how to hold them, how to move our bodies. And he counted Hacha, Hugwa, Tulu, Futfut, Lima. Then we counted the edge of our paddles skimming the dirt. There's no last legend because distance is so full of light. The Sackman moves further than braids of the native sun, further than rope burns. Sina, and our bodies blessed with coconut oil, rainwater, charcoal, white lime, soil, palm leaves, salt water. Is remembered we went to Hagatnya Boat Basin, small canoe, no outrigger, no sail, the five of us, Mr. Flores in another canoe alongside, counting Hacha, Hugwa, Tulu, Futfut, Lima. We repeat, re-paddle the current, our bodies aligned, row in the apparent wind, past the breakwater, past the reef. The salt wind trades in things unknown. Even without the names of the stars, even when we lost contact, it will never be too dark for us to see. Hungan, 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 Magahit. In the landscape with canoe approaching, once upon a time, dead air during return, what do we have outside their pursuit as we once were because our bodies are 60% water? Hungen, 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 Magahit. Will the renaming of the world ever stop as once passed down Sina, arriving home and no one threw ashes in my eyes, once lived here because our blood is nearly 80% water? Hungen, 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 Magahit. Is remembered in the summer after freshman year, my parents decided to move to California. Most of our possessions sold. I was scared, so close to the Matson ship, scared on the airplane to San Francisco. I was 15 years old. I am 30 now. I can still feel the burn of movement in my body from pulling the current, still the movement rooted in my body, still overseas, aerial, still to be still. The Goliath is at my sister's apartment in Fremont, California, and the Sacman is at my parents' house in Santa Clara, California. Sometimes the only weapon is the shape of a canoe. As it once was, our body on reef edge, our breath becoming conch shell, once belonged because our lungs are nearly 90% water. Hungen, 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 Magahit. Sina, inspected by customs, once died naturally. To see with the eye of the wind as we once will, we rise from the wake in irons in the theft of the sun, as we once are, because the Pacific Ocean is 5 parts land to 1,000 parts water. Hungen, 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 Magahit, Hanum, Hanum, Hanum. Thank you. So my ancestors and a lot of islanders in the Western Pacific were very famous for being navigators. There are a lot of kind of indigenous trade routes throughout the Pacific. And what the Spanish did when they came is they burned all the canoes and they killed the navigators as a way to kind of immobilize the population. And so once you destroy people's canoe, they can't get off the island. It was easy for them to put us into kind of Catholic parishes. So they also kind of rearrange, settlement patterns and things like that. And so unfortunately, within a few generations of Spanish colonialism, our navigational and canoe building traditions were lost. And it wasn't until a few decades ago that folks on Guam started relearning this tradition from other islanders. And so that poem is kind of inspired by a group called Tasi, which is Traditions About Seafaring Islands. Tasi in our language means ocean or sea. And they had built a traditional canoe, a big one called Sacman is the name for the large one. And they named it Sina, which is our word for like ancestor or parent. And it was, it was very kind of exciting cultural event for us to, revive these traditions. And when they sailed it for the first time in the waters around the island, it was the first time our traditional canoes could be seen in our waters in like 3 centuries. So I've been thinking a lot about, what that kind of mobility means in terms of also this kind of new Chamorro migration patterns. So the recent census, 2010, for the first time, there are more Chamorros who live off-island than live on-island. So about 50,000 Chamorros still live in Guam. About 70,000 of us live in Hawaii, along the West Coast. Different military bases in Texas, Virginia. And, for those who know my work, I write a lot about the military, militarization on Guam. And kind of the military is one of the main kind of migration streams on island. So I come from a military family. My dad was in the Army. My mother's father was in the Marines. And so, mobility is kind of this vexed thing for me. So, it's both a good thing that we have these navigational practice back, but also this thing where it's like, the airplane has kind of replaced our canoe, so many people leaving home, and what kind of implications that has. So this next poem I want to read is also from my upcoming book. And it's called The Micronesian Kingfisher. And it's kind of based off of, or at least somewhat inspired by Olson's famous poem, The Kingfishers. And in Guam, we used to have kind of a very vibrant native bird population. Unfortunately, during World War II and after kind of U.S. militarization, military buildup, these brown tree snakes came to island as stowaways on these military cargo ships. There were no stakes on Guam before, and so the birds had no defenses against them. Some of our birds were even flightless. And within a few, within like 10 years, these snakes colonized the entire island. And now we have the most dense population of snakes than anywhere else in the world. We also have lost all our bird populations. So growing up on Guam, you know, you go into the jungles, it's eerie because there's this silence. You don't hear any birds. Okay. So, you know, imagine an island space with no birds. Yeah. And this particular bird I'm writing about, the Micronesian kingfisher, of course, is a kind of species kingfisher. It's endemic or native to the island. In our language, it's called sihik. Beautiful bird. We get to learn about these birds in school, but I've never actually seen one in person. And so what happened in the 80s is that Guam became this kind of hotbed for conservation, you know, activities, kind of the same time as you know, environmental protection policies, Endangered Species Act were becoming popular in the U.S. And so a lot of you know, conservationists came to Guam to try to save the birds. Yeah. And so this poem is about kind of ecological colonialism. It's about what happened to these birds after they were saved. So what happened, these zookeepers came and they got all the last birds. There were 29 of them. Okay. And they took them back to U.S. zoos to be, you know, kept for captive breeding purposes. And so now the kingfisher population is about 150 right now. They're all live in captivity in different zoos across the U.S. You know, and I wanted to write this poem because not a lot of my people really know what happened to these birds after they were taken from island. Yeah. So it's a difficult poem for me to read, but I'll try because it's very emotional. But one last bit of information is that the last wild birds were seen in Guam in 1988. Okay, so it's been a while since these birds have been wild. The Micronesian kingfisher, Isihik. Our nightmare, no bird song. The jungle was riven, emptied of Isihik. Bright blue, green, turquoise, red, gold feathers. Everywhere, brown tree snakes, avian silence. The snakes entered without words. When we saw them, it was too late. They were at our door, sliding along the passages of Isihik Empire. Then the zookeepers came, called it Species Survival Plan, captured Isihik, and transferred the last 29 Micronesian kingfishers to zoos for captive breeding, 1988. They repeated Isihik, and repeated, if it weren't for us, the birds would be gone forever. What does not change? Last wild scene. Exterior features, quarter-inch plywood, screened mesh cage front, Isihik, with bumpers and burlap shield. Interior ceiling, foam rubber or burlap stuffed with straw. External minimum size, 9 inch by 9 inch. Internal height, minimum 10 inch clearance between floor and ceiling padding. Perching, Isihik, 1/2 inch diameter. The recommended minimum enclosure size for breeding pairs, 10 feet by 8 feet, with the height of 10 feet containment. This cage, Isihik, can be either solid material, wire mesh, or glass. For wire enclosures, mesh size should not exceed 1 inch. Kingfishers have attacked, their images reflected in glass cage fronts. These are not legends. The birds are birds inside snake belly Isihik, no longer averting pests or spreading seeds. Nest Isihik. Logs should be a minimum of 2 feet in length, with a diameter of no less than 15 inches. It may be difficult to place nest logs at this height in captivity. The core of the log should be exposed so the birds have access to the soft center, Isihik, without excavating the hard outer bark. The National Zoo has had success using a pulley system to lower and raise the nest log to check for eggs. On these displays, Isihik, what does not change is born and fed and grows and dies. Quote, a rare Micronesian kingfisher hatched at the National Zoo's Conservation and Research Center. The chick weighed 5.5 grams, 2004, Isihik. Quote, our newest pair of Micronesian kingfishers at the San Diego Zoo is currently raising a chick, 2007, Isihik. When snakes arrive, the jungle rives. Quote, two of Guam's endangered Micronesian kingfishers were released from quarantine at the Department of Agriculture. The female birds arrived in Guam about a month ago from the Philadelphia Zoo. Both were hatched at the St. Louis Zoo, courtesy of Continental Airlines Pet Safe Program 2008, Isihik. Quote, the St. Louis Zoo has hatched 41 chicks since 1985. Recent modifications to birdhouse habitats have now made it possible to house a pair of these rare birds for visitors. What does not change is the will to see. Trespass, Isihik. When land is caged, we are theft, Isihik. Caged within our disappearance, Isihik. Quote, a mated pair of Guam Micronesian kingfishers laid two fertile eggs this spring deep inside a hollowed-out palm log in a special breeding room of the Lincoln Park Zoo birdhouse. Keepers promptly stole one of the eggs. The parents incubated and hatched one egg in the hollow log. The other egg hatched a few days later inside an incubation machine in a lab where the chick now lives, fed by keepers from tweezers protruding beneath the beak of an oversized kingfisher hand puppet, 2010, Isihik. Invasion is a continuous chain of immeasurably destructive events in time, is the death of origins, is a stillborn Isihik future, is the ending of all nests, this choked thing we, Isihik. What does not change is the will to colonize. Isihik, risk, being. Isihik, as weapons mount. Isihik, rise above fences. Isihik. Thank you. Okay, I'll end with one last poem. This kind of will kind of finish the canned meat trilogy that I have in my next book. Let's find this poem. Okay, it's called Corned Beef Unrationed. And there's an epigraph from Brandy Nalani McDougall, a Hawaiian poet, from her poem called What a Young Single Makuahine Feed You, Single Mom. Quote goes, from uncle, no matter which uncle, you eat whatever uncle brings. Corned beef hash on ration. Hash is the perfect high. That's corned beef hash for any law enforcement officer reading this poem. This kind of hash is not a controlled substance, but it is addictive. If you recently purchased 12-ounce cans of Hormel corned beef in natural juices on Guam, they may contain an animal deworming drug called ivermectin. What's called corned beef is simply a poorly preserved beef imported from South America. Spread corned beef on banana leaf, overlap suni leaves, place meat in center, form a cup with suni leaves, pour in coconut milk, close leaves, fold banana leaf, tie, bake for 1 hour in earth oven. Note, extremely high in fat. To reduce, replace up to half a coconut milk with whole milk. Hence the Chamorro special, fried rice, 2 eggs any style, and 1 corned beef patty, $9.95. Conclusion, canned corned beef won't get you high unless we're talking about your cholesterol. Simply Food, a vegetarian restaurant on Guam, serves a soy corned beef. I avoid soy for cultural reasons. After the war, many Chamorros stayed in refugee camps. Chamorros who served as cooks in the Navy prepped the daily feedings, salvaged Japanese rice and American excess C and D rations, corned beef and hash, powdered eggs, and Navy-issue coffee with cream and sugar. My grandma says it was like manna from heaven. When I lived in Ka'ava last summer with my future wife, she seduced me with breakfast of corned beef hash, hapa rice, and 2 eggs, any style. For dessert, I consume her body because it's no longer a secret. Canned meat is warrior food. Modernization, global food trade, convenience, affordability, prestige, Western economic theories of development, trapezoid cans. The rise of obesity began as U.S. invasive foods reached the islands in the 60s and 70s. But you know what my uncles always say, buy global, but cook it local style. Their impact on the Chamorro diet still resonates today. I wonder how many of my relatives will carry the global burden of disease. On Sundays after Mass, my grandmother makes corned beef hash patties coated with seasoned flour and fried in onions and chili and served with white rice and 2 eggs, any style. We ate without making a sound because we thought she stole this food from the white god. But now I live in Honolulu and shop at Kukua Market, Down to Earth and Whole Foods. Nevertheless, I have fond memories of those canned meat Sundays, my indigenous grandma, and her heroic efforts to make us believe we were the best-fed children in all of Uncle's empire. Thank you. So thank you again for your attention. I think for folks who can stay, there's a Q&A. So I'm happy to answer any questions about the poems, about the old work, new work, about life as a poet. I will give a copy to the first two people who ask me questions of these two books. Reader's copy, free. As long as they're not a dumb question. Okay. Awesome.
It's sort of a dumb question.
No worries, I was just kidding about that.
I had a chance to sort of skim through Saina.
Yeah.
And I noticed that when you were reading, you were sort of like skimming through. So I'm wondering about the construction of the book. And does the poem actually continue sort of in those fragments throughout?
Yeah. So, you know, each book is an excerpt, as I mentioned, and each poem within the books are excerpts, so they all carry the kind of the from Orange Tomorrow, the Ginnin. And so what I tried to do in terms of putting the book together is I wanted to weave these different fragments, different excerpts. And so I've been thinking a lot about you know, kind of indigenous practices, indigenous aesthetics, and you know, trying to ground my own aesthetic practice, or to indigenize, you know, this poetic work within these indigenous aesthetic traditions. And so weaving it is one way I kind of think about that. You know, another way is in the second, actually my first book, I taught a lot about my grandfather kind of teaching me how to weave a fishing net, yeah, a throw net. And so that's also kind of another motif that goes through. So, you know, I'm trying to also think about how this work is kind of like a net as well. Yeah. And so, you know, reading the book, you kind of get different excerpts throughout. So that piece I read, Aerial Roots, is in 10 different excerpts. And that poem actually continues in the next book as well, but in a different way. Yeah. So, which one would you like?
Can I have Saina?
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So I got one more free book for the next question to break the ice. Yes?
So it sounds like there was a lot of research that went into all the poems that you read. I'm curious like what your process is for picking what stands out as this is the research that's going to go directly into the poem versus maybe retell this in a different way.
That's a great question. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of research, a lot of history in the book, and you know, in my own kind of in Chamorro storytelling traditions, kind of our oral traditions were a way for us to communicate history, you know, spirituality, you know, moral lessons as well, entertainment, and so I kind of want my work to also reflect that tradition. So there's a little bit of kind of entertaining humor. There's history, there's family stories, there's cultural stories, there's information about the landscape, about geography, about migration and movement, yeah. Now, there's so much, you know, information or text out there, especially if you're like me and you're far from home, and, you know, the only way I can stay connected, or at least one way I can stay connected, is through reading histories, yeah. And so choosing what to leave in and what to leave out is always a difficult choice. A lot of it is intuitive. Yeah, I try to, you know, kind of connect things thematically. The first poem I read from this book, Achoti, is all about things that were red, because Achoti is red. And so I was thinking about, well, what in our history is about red? And that led me to kind of, you know, a lot of the bloodshed that poem talks about. Now, what's fun about working in a long form or in serial pieces is that you don't have to, those hard choices that you make for individual poems, you could kind of disseminate it further because you have opportunities to retell stories. Yeah. So information that, let's say, doesn't go into that poem, I could put it in a later book. And so I do that a lot in my work. So there's a lot of stuff about migration and aerial routes in my second book that just didn't fit the theme of navigation or canoe building. So that a lot of that information is then in my third book, in the same poem called Aerial Roots. Yeah. And so, you know, this is also kind of grounding my work, you know, grounding this kind of textual poetics within a kind of oral tradition too, where, you know, with a lot of oral telling, it's never the same thing told, you know, the same story told at each oral performance, right? It's always different depending on the audience or the situation. And so for me, each book gives me the opportunity to rearticulate the story in a different way, yeah? And, you know, and at the same time kind of echo back to different moments in previous poems. So it's a tricky balance for sure. But it's fun too, because I think when you have, you know, some history in your poems, it kind of grounds more of the family stories, kind of grounds some of the more lyric moments or the more abstract kind of intellectual moments. So I kind of like that about finding these different currents that run through the stories. Yeah. Thank you, though. You get this copy. I'll give it to you after. You got it, right?
Other questions?
I do have a special guest today. You still down to perform? I know you just got here.
It's true.
All right.
You had a question over here.
All right, I'll take the question, and then there's another Chamorro poet in the house. You know, as in the 2010 census, Chamorros were categorized as the most dispersed peoples within the U.S. empire. So there are actually a lot of Chamorros out here. So I invited a friend to perform with me today. Unfortunately, he got stuck behind on one of the trains, something like that. But maybe he'll spit a piece for us before folks go. So I'll take a question, then I'll let you do your thing. Yeah. That's a great question. I was writing a little bit, but I was 15 years old. So, you know, I wasn't really writing with any kind of seriousness. It wasn't really till I moved, you know, started a new high school in California. You know, it was like the new kid in school, didn't have any friends. You know, it was kind of like intense culture shock. And writing, you know, kind of gave me something to do during lunchtime. And, you know, after school, and I was like, I was very homesick, and so writing was a way for me to stay connected, you know, to my home island, home culture. And then because, at least when I was growing up on Guam, you know, we didn't have any Chamorro language or history or culture taught in the schools, because, you know, American school system. And so, you know, that was when I was like, oh, I started ordering Guam history books, you know, like different kinds of anthropological and archaeological texts about Guam. And, you know, that's why I think, because I was reading a lot of that stuff, I think that's why that kind of the history and all this kind of information kind of entered my work, because I was, like, trying to process, you know, what it means to learn about your culture when you're removed from it so far away. So, yeah, I really didn't start writing till after I entered the diaspora, and I was like, oh, how can I stay connected, right? So poetry really, you know, gave me that kind of aerial root connection back home, yeah. But thank you. So I'm going to bring up Dakota Camacho. And he's an awesome poet. This is actually my first time meeting him in person. I've seen his work online. He's been involved with the spoken word poetry movement back in Guam. He's now a graduate student?
No, but I'm graduating undergraduate studies.
Shit. At Madison. Mm-hmm. So he came all the way out here today. And he's an amazing performer. Does like hip hop theater, chanting, He's involved with this group called Archaeologists, mm-hmm. which they do what they call edutainment. Mm-hmm. So it's like educational yet entertaining poetry for the youth back home. Mm-hmm. And I've been very much inspired by the work that they've done, so I'm going to turn it over to him.
Word, thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
No word.
Hello, y'all. Just so you know, the purple train is not running between the downtown loop and Howard. can I actually move the podium? One, two, three.
We'll just do it this way.
Word. Thanks. And I was not sure the whole time that so I'm involved with this group back home called Ifangalaya, which means the place of chant. We're a traditional chant group. We're also involved in recovering and promoting the oral tradition through Fino Hadza, which is the pre-contact form of the language. The group is involved in reconstructing the pre-contact form of the language to keep stories that are very deep and old. And so the piece that I'm going to share is a blend of spoken word. I'm a hip-hop scholar at the University of Madison, Wisconsin, through the First Wave hip-hop scholarship. It's a full tuition scholarship for hip-hop. I don't know how I ended up there, but that's how. So that's the piece that I'm going to do. Ni na la ti I ha li ni na la ti I ha li ni na la ti I ha li. Here, this lackey, post of the old souls of your ancestors, down thou motna, all the way to Ponte, the navigator who is a seed, Zenfotna, the first energy. Ma hetuki atsuki gima uli tau. Ha! Ha! Stone! Ha! Holds up our homes. Ha! Yatsu don. Stone. The land. Where all of our old bones are buried deep within the sand. Uncle Sam owns a third of our island. And once more, to store nuclear weapons and Agent Orange. He says they protect us from war.
Atsualutunitautaumami! They came, fired metal bullets at us. We threw ours back at them, hand carved from stone. Brought us diseases our kukna have never known. And now they say this land is not our own. We're 4,000 years old. Do you know what kind of seas we sailed to get here? Our people have survived through every assault. Because we are forged of basalt. We are red, hot, in liquid, black, rock, and stone. Itao! Itao da mami! Namatanya! Imenye lumu! Make your family fearless.
Peace. So, there's a one-man hip-hop theater show called Latin Bombs.
Buried beneath Latin bombs.
Yeah. So, you know, if you ever get a chance to check it out, I know he's doing a few shows.
Well, hopefully again in the Midwest, but if not, you have to wait until folks bring me back. Yeah.
Awesome. So if we have time, we have to take, both of us will take questions if you guys.